pulling back the curtain of silence
and learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen, Brown-Eyed Activism.
Healing at the intersections.
So today we're talking about body image. And I know that you came into this conversation with so much awareness of your position.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Black woman. I'm able-bodied. I don't suffer from any known chronic illness or disease that impacts my body or the way that it looks, you know, or the way that I feel in my body. And I'm thin, and I've always been this way. So I feel like while I can offer lots about body positivity by way of experiencing things like, you know, anti-Blackness, because I'm a dark-skinned Black woman in a non-white body, I really think that we need to center our perspectives of like fat women, specifically women who aren't skinny, women whose bodies have been marked as less desirable. These do include brown and Black women, but I just wanted to, you know, set the stage with that.
Yeah, and thank you for that, because yeah, it can be really easy for those of us with a lot of structural privilege to fall into the trap of thinking we just need to love ourselves.
Right.
Right. So much body positivity is like that. And in reality, there is no amount of loving ourselves that can save us from structural oppression and violence.
Totally.
Yeah. So like if your doctor refuses to take your health concerns seriously because they see you as fat and they assume that any problems you have are caused by your weight, then loving yourself is not going to magically get you appropriate medical care.
Totally.
Right? And that's just one example. But we're going to also open the conversation up more, because when we started thinking about body image, our brains went to diet culture and beauty culture first.
Yeah.
But then we realized that there is so much more that affects the way we see and understand our bodies.
Yeah. And for me, like, I don't know, body positivity has become like this thing. It's like it's become the air that I breathe, where I like I've spent so much time and energy recently affirming my body, which it never stemmed from being like I want to change it necessarily. It just it has become like this kind of cool journey in which I'm like, oh, this is what I've got. All right, this shit's cool. Like I've never hated my body. And I don't think body positivity has to come after that. Like, I think it can be, you know what I'm trying to say? Like, I think oftentimes the conversation of body positivity is like, you either hate, like, you don't hate it, love it. And it's like, there can be some shades of gray in between, you know, how you feel about it from day to day.
Right. And it's, it's so much more complicated than that. It's not just about good body, bad body. It's not just about loving my body, hating my body.
Yeah, totally.
Because really, it's about a relationship. And relationships are very complicated.
Yes, so the ebb and flow. Some days you're like, oh, I feel this. Sometimes I feel that.
Yeah. So much goes into it. There is so much outside of the relationship that comes into the relationship.
That impacts how you feel about the relationship.
Exactly.
You know.
So we're talking about relationships that we have with our bodies. We're talking about the way we relate to other people's bodies, the ways they relate to ours. So lots to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But something, a big thing that came up was bodies as a site of oppression. So what does it do to our relationships with our bodies when our bodies mark us for violence and oppression?
Right.
So that might be because my body has a certain color of skin. My body has a certain hair texture. My body is understood as being a particular sex or gender.
Yeah. And what can that do to you? I mean, it can make you resent those things.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, like, one thing that I didn't love when I was growing up, which is hilarious now because I don't have any hair, which is like my hair. I didn't love, you know, I have like 4C hair. If you don't know what that is, look it up. It's very, very, very tight curl patterns. My hair wouldn't fall into like a beautiful, like typical fro, as people will like, I understand fros to be like more of like the 4A or 3BC variety. You know, beautiful ringlets. My hair doesn't do that. It takes a lot of work to get that. For me, it was like I didn't grow up liking that shit at all. I thought it was like difficult. A lot of the times that's how Black hair is described. That's the word that's used, is it's difficult.
Right.
And that's why we do things like, and this isn't to say that all Black women who, you know, change our hair do this because our hair is difficult. No, it's just because our hair is so malleable and it's actually fucking rad that it can hold so many different types of hairstyles because of the texture of it. But yeah, like I think you can grow up resenting certain features, and it's hilarious that now I have a shaved head because it's like, I love my hair. I do love my hair, but I like to keep it short. Not because it's difficult, because I feel my best self when I'm short haired.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, but it's complicated.
It is.
And I remember, so I didn't ever, I wouldn't say I wanted to be white per se, but I do very much remember feeling very strongly that I would be treated differently if I was.
Right.
And we talked about this in our pilot, just wanting to be seen as the person that you see yourself as.
Yeah. And or how you see other people being treated when they're themselves.
Exactly.
You know?
And so when it feels like your body is the thing in the way of being seen and loved and treated with respect, you can start to hate your body.
Totally. It's that's a really good way of putting it. And I think it's so complicated. Like I said, like I have that privilege that I mentioned, and I've always had that privilege.
Right.
Of like being thin, being athletic, like all those kinds of things. So desirability was fucked up. Like the way that I perceive people desiring my body meant a lot to me when I was younger. Now it's different. Like things have changed, and mostly in that, like, I desire my body. Mm-hmm. I like my body. But to have your body be the site of oppression, and that you're treated in different ways, like you're sexualized in different ways because of your body, because, like, for myself, blackness is like a marker of a site of oppression that I've experienced. When you couple that with femininity, black femininity, it's like, okay, you're inherently more sexual, for example, and that's a site of oppression. But that there are levels to this shit, right? Like there are black fat women. And so these layers of the ways in which if a black woman was just a black woman, she's treated in one particular way, and things become contorted, and the way that she's treated as a black fat woman is very different. And I think it's important to just be mindful of those things, because similar to other conversations we've had about like blanket terms like body positivity or girl power or whatever,
right,
can be sites of erasure. I think it's like, what are we being positive of, and how have those things been perceived as negative aren't always just flat.
Totally.
Like just like this or that. It's like there's nuance to the way in which a fat black body is perceived as a woman,
yeah,
versus a fat black body is perceived as a gender nonconforming person.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. And then I want to talk a little bit about this concept of social dysmorphia.
Tell me more.
We've heard, a lot of us have heard of body dysmorphia, mm-hmm, which is basically when you see your body differently than it is. So it comes up a lot in the context, for example, of eating disorders, where,
yeah,
someone might see themselves as being much larger than they are in reality.
Right.
So social dysmorphia is this idea that the way you see yourself and the way you see your body and your identity and all of those things is being contorted by the way other people view you.
Mm.
So people see you and therefore treat you in a particular way, and it changes your idea of who you are.
Yeah.
Creates these feelings of dissonance,
yeah,
and dysmorphia and pain and discomfort, because,
yeah,
especially with people who have very marginalized identities, so somebody who is, you know, not only black, but also maybe trans and also maybe fat. So they're experiencing it from the vast majority of the population, and they don't have a lot of spaces where all of who they are is accepted, or where there is somewhere they can go and just be themselves and be seen for that.
Right.
That is where social dysmorphia is going to happen the most, right? Because we're social creatures.
Yeah.
So we don't just know ourselves. We get to know ourselves through our relationships.
Mm-hmm. You know what I realized is in this conversation, we've used the word fat a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to speak to like the choice in using words.
Yeah, thank you.
Only because it's taken me some time to feel comfortable being able to use fat in a way that isn't used in the same way that it's commonly applied.
Right.
Oftentimes we use the word fat to describe bodies that are larger, and it's a negative connotation.
Mm-hmm.
Fatness as gross or grotesque or undesirable or any of those kinds of things. And that's so harmful. That's so harmful for people who don't have thin privilege. Talking about people's bodies in ways that associate them with being less than, in the
mm-hmm.
way that we commonly use the word fat, for example, and it's tied to other things like this person is lazy or doesn't care about themselves or all these kinds of things, is super unhelpful. But what is helpful is recognizing the difference between an adjective that is just that, it describes, versus something that has the weight of structural oppression, like
mm-hmm.
when we use the word fat in ways that are harmful. And I just wanted to say that, like, I'm not, this isn't my notes. I'm just like,
yeah,
I think,
and
it's
totally, thank you. And specifically, the reason that I use that word in these contexts is because of the people who are leading this work. And
mm-hmm.
so I've heard from a lot of amazing activists who are leading the way on this that it's very harmful when fat is used as this pejorative.
Yes.
And that there has been this movement to politicize that and reclaim it in a way that's positive. So understanding that literal fat has been demonized.
Yes.
On our bodies. Yes. And that there's actually nothing wrong with fat. It's a part of, we all have it. Yeah. It's a part of all of our bodies.
Right.
And there is absolutely nothing wrong with it. Actually, it's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this choice to embrace and politicize.
In the same way that we reclaim words like queer.
Yeah.
In the same way that we reclaim words like nigga as Black people. Taking the piss out of it, as people say, and making it something that applies to you in a way that is profoundly personal and no longer has the pejorative from where it was like originally
came
from.
Yeah. And we're still two people within privilege who are finding our ways through this conversation. And I was actually wanting to share, because this is a very much a moving topic for me. It's something I'm like actively doing work around and learning about, because my body type is naturally thin. And also someone very close to me when I was a child had anorexia. And so for both of those reasons, very much have never engaged in diets. It's something that I've just refused to go there, even when I have had insecurities.
Yes.
So I've kind of, in a way, I understand we're all affected by it, but I've almost seen myself as outside of diet culture.
Yeah. And that's honestly one of the reasons why when we first started planning for this episode, I was like, I don't know what I can say, like, as a person that's thin. Like, I need to recognize, and we had the chat of that, it's not just about, you know, being accepting your body for if it's a bigger body, for example. There's levels to it. But I, like you, kind of saw myself on the periphery of that conversation. I didn't really recognize how I'm complicit, for example, in like fat phobia.
Absolutely. But then when you look at our complicity in the broader system, something that got called out that really made me think, I think it was Ijoma Oluo who had said that people who wear standard sizing shouldn't shop at places that don't carry large sizes.
Yeah,
because then we're just making it okay for these companies to not even offer a range of sizes for the, you know, that reflects the population.
Yeah,
right. But we can choose to shop anywhere because our size is going to be anywhere, and it doesn't really affect us as individuals that plus size people can't get clothes almost anywhere, can't get cute clothes, you know?
Yeah. I see that. I never thought about that once in my fucking life.
And so then I think another question then is what the consequences are. So we're starting to talk a little bit about what are the structural consequences of the way other people perceive our bodies. So we've talked about shopping a little bit. I mentioned at the beginning about, you know, medical care. Another huge one is violence, interpersonal violence. So if you are perceived as a woman, if you're perceived as feminine, regardless of your gender identity, if you're perceived as racialized, if you're Black or brown, you're so much more likely to experience violence.
And then if you're on the margins of those things where you're like, you might present as both, you know, feminine and masculine, you're feminine but not feminine enough, and now it's like a violent interaction that results, you know?
Yeah, because there is this idea that the gender binary and heterosexuality are natural, right? And yet they're so violently policed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously they're not natural because there's all of these people who are naturally a different way other than the binary. They don't fit into these very strict boxes.
Yeah.
But then there is so much violence to try to force them back into those
spaces, those
boxes, to try to teach them a lesson
totally.
For daring to go with outside of what's expected of them in terms of gender or sexuality.
Yeah. And then there's like just the added with specifically with like fat bodies. I'm thinking about like how we were mentioning the binary of like this or that.
Yeah.
And then being on like the, not on the outskirts, but being in between, that in betweenness, or being having that duality, for example, about being like, let's say you are like a fat, Black, queer, disabled, very, you know, polyamorous, gender nonconforming person. Like the kind, I'm thinking about the ways in which the more your identity is on the periphery or marginalized by systemic oppressions, the greater likelihood it is that you're going to be like have violence enacted upon you because of all of those systems of oppression that were always intended to harm you.
Yeah, the less safe you are. And that is everything from street harassment, from being yelled at or actually physically assaulted on the street, sexual violence, corrective violence, whether that's coming from even your parents that, you know,
it's like punitive, like when your parents like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Like when someone who, you know, the parents think this is a little boy and this quote unquote boy is acting feminine.
Yeah.
There is this attempt to correct that behavior by exacting very harsh punishment, whether that's emotional abuse, physical abuse.
Right.
And violence is so very common. I mean, most women that I know have experienced sexual violence.
Yes, me too.
As well as, no pun intended, me too.
Oh, God. This is how you make the jokes, people. If you're thinking
you
about making the jokes,
you should watch the Michelle Wolf skit about this. Anyways.
Yes, yes.
And not just women. I mean, people of many gender identities, including a lot of boys, experience sexual abuse as children. Mm-hmm. And adult men do as well, not as at great rates, but it's very common.
Yes.
Right? And this kind of violence, once that violence has happened, then what does that do to our relationship with our bodies?
Right. And that's, we talked about this in our Me Too episode, but in my experience with my sexual assault, like one of them specifically, it made me resent my body. It made me hate my body, made me not trust my body. It made me feel like my body was dirty and broken and like not worthy anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
And a lot of times the consequences of violence make our bodies a really scary and painful place to live.
Yeah.
So I know for me, in the aftermath of experiencing a lot of violence, I got really bad panic attacks. And so really what was happening was my body's danger signal was just broken. It just thought there was danger all the time.
Right.
Because it was still living. There was a part of me, a part of my system that was still stuck in this place in the past where the violence was happening. And so when the danger signal is going off and there's nothing dangerous happening around me, my body would look inside. So it would be, I'm having a heart attack.
Right.
I can't breathe.
Yeah.
Things like that. Mm-hmm. And so it was just terrifying on a daily basis to feel like there was something wrong with me internally, to have these body sensations that were terrifying, that made me feel like I should go to the hospital or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Totally. I also live with chronic pain, so having experienced a lot of trauma, that just made me very tense because, you know, you're bracing against the trauma, essentially.
Yeah.
And so chronic pain has become a big issue, and so it's literally painful to live in my body at times. So
it's like there's endless, the list is very long.
Yeah, well, it's just when we were talking about our relationships with our bodies and what are the outside factors that get in the middle, right?
So many fucking things.
The violence happens and then there is the legacy of it in our body. Or there's the ways that we've been made to feel, oh, last time I felt this good. And this is true for a lot of femmes. I think it was Alok. I wish I knew how to say their last name. So Alok Vaidmenon is the best I can do
right
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't hate us. But also hold us accountable and let us know how to say that properly.
Yes, please. Alok had a post about the fact that for a lot of femmes, the times that we've felt the most beautiful and free are the times we've experienced the most violence.
Mm.
And I know that it is so much more true for trans femmes like Alok, but also even for myself as a cis queer femme in a brown body, there's been so many times, you know, in the summer and I'm wearing a dress that makes me feel so beautiful and I just feel so good in my body and I feel relaxed. And then the amount of like vile comments that I get just make me never want to wear that dress again.
Totally.
And I love it so much, you know.
And it's like the association between that dress and then like, but the dress is really not the thing. It's like your body wearing that dress is the thing that's the problem that, you know.
Right. Because that's the thing that we can control. If I can't control them, well, I can control my body, or I think I can control my body, or I can control what I put on my body.
Sure.
And so that.
So becomes, then you become like, oh man, why did I wear this thing? Like, I shouldn't have done this. I knew better. I should have not. Next time I'm gonna wear a paper bag. Like, you know, it's that type of shit. Yeah. And like in the conversation of like beauty and specifically diet culture, I think like that's another site of, in my mind, violence. Like, diet culture is quite violent.
It is.
I was fortunate to have a mom who was like, I don't want you guys to say specific things about your bodies in this house. Mm. Like, she didn't let us talk shit about our bodies. She just was like, nope, wow. Nope, nope. You're not allowed. That's a bad word. Can't say that shit. Not allowed to say that.
Wow.
And it was mostly because she was like, hey, listen, when I was growing up, I didn't, like, you know, come into my full feminine form until I was, like, in my late teens. I was that person that you're talking about. You know, I wasn't the cute girl that everybody, like, was into. I wasn't that person. So all the thing, I think she just recognized, like, she connected the dots between how she felt about her body.
Yeah.
And then she saw us, like, black girls growing up, repeating those kinds of inner dialogues, but, like, openly at home.
Right.
And she just wouldn't tolerate that. As much as I had my own internal, like, dialogue about how I dislike parts of my body and still, like, have those kinds of conversations with myself. I might not externalize them, but I'll say them. I can always recall back on, like, my mom's words of just, like, you're black and you're beautiful and you're going to hold your head up high. And, like, that was just kind of, like, the mantra in our house.
Right. I'm also curious, though, about that discussion of what it's okay for you to wear and what's appropriate. Mm. Because I think that's something that happens so much to girls where we're told
how to.
We need to cover ourselves because men will see us, because it's not fair to men. I got this a lot, actually, growing up from my mom. Basically, the idea that it's not fair to men to dress too revealing.
Like, you're being a tease? Like, the idea of being a tease?
Yeah, or, well, there was, like, a couple of different specific ways that I remember. One was around being at school. Hmm. So it's like, oh, these poor boys, and then they see these things, and it might turn them on, and then, like, that might, you know, they might have an erection at school, and, like, these poor boys, like, that.
But also, like, boys have erections just, like, doing random time. Shit. Yeah. Like, no, like, at that age in high school, it's like, exactly. They're just, like, that's just happening because their bodies are, like, exactly. Developing. What the fuck are we talking about?
Exactly. And, like, you can't protect
them from that. And, like, right. Also, like, that's a you body thing. Like, that's their bodies. It's not your body. What does it have to do with you?
Exactly. Even, like, or adult male relatives being around, sort of being like, it's not fair to these adult male relatives to be dressed.
Wow,
like,
why are we sexualizing children in, like, in your own family? That's fucking not cool.
Yeah. So that was in your house
now? No, not at all. Cool. Like, I think, sorry to, like, fucking be like, that's fucking weird. But, like, that's so foreign to me, I think. Like, my mom was very much like, my dad didn't have opinions about that shit. He never actually said anything about that. My parents were both like, they never talked about sex. Right. My mom was very much just like, I won't have you leaving the house with lipstick that dark. You are 16 years old. When you are 19 years old, you can do whatever the fuck you want with your face, and that's that on that. Like, there was no conversation. Hmm. Like, it was more, it was just like,
how do you think you interpreted that? Like,
I knew what she was trying to say, but she was never outright. Like, she was never like, oh, you know, like, your cleavage is too much because of, like, and I didn't desire to dress that way anyways because I grew up going to Christian school, right? But I definitely grew up with having, like, a Christian school dress code. I had uniforms, and, like, there were certain things you couldn't do to modify your uniform. We would always roll our skirts up and stuff like that. Like, we had these, like, weird kilts, and they would have these, like, I guess they were like construction paper hands that were, like, stenciled attached to a ruler. Our homeroom teachers would, like, take this, like, construction paper hand that was attached to a ruler and put it on, like, the lowest part of the hand touching the highest part of your knee. Mm-hmm. And if your skirt was rolled up too high, and if it was more than, you know, a hand's width of rolling up, you got to go home and change, mm-hmm. or you got to roll that shit back.
And how do you think that affected you? I guess I'm curious, just because I'm wondering about, for myself, the ways that those messages when I was growing up around needing to, like, cover up, that came from my family, but also came from the school. And I'm wondering how those messages then played into, when I did experience sexual violence, how I felt about
yourself,
myself, and what I was wearing.
Yeah. You know what? Like, after my sexual assault that happened on my birthday years ago, at the time, I was volunteering with a rape crisis center. I think as much as I had a lot of shame and a lot of disgust about my body and I felt betrayed by my body, I also simultaneously knew, like, it didn't matter what I was wearing. Like, so, that was the thing, you know? Like,
yeah, I get that. But I guess for me, I knew mm-hmm. that it's not supposed to matter. Like, mm-hmm. that's, like, the stereotypical victim blaming. It's your dress is too short, right?
Yeah.
But I also know that with the dress that I was wearing, again, it's this thing of when you feel the best and then violence happens, the way you internalize that, because it was a short dress, and it was something that I had experienced street harassment mm-hmm. wearing that same dress.
Yeah.
You know? And so then it definitely became, as much as I knew intellectually that's not supposed to matter.
Yeah.
there is a sense of shame that I was picking up. And I have an understanding of emotions as not just being individual things within you. Like, emotions are also social and they can be created in relationships, and then you can just kind of pick up on the energy that exists.
Agreed.
And I think,
yeah,
I think that with a lot of these dress codes, or, you know, my mom telling me or my grandma telling me to cover up more, making comments about my outfits, there was this palpable shame, you know, and I don't think it belonged to me, but I think I could sense it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think after I experienced sexual violence, I feel like that shame became, it just came to live in my body so much more, you know, and it didn't matter that I knew intellectually that that wasn't supposed to be my, you know,
fault.
It wasn't supposed to matter.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still felt that shame.
I still felt the shame, specifically after my sexual assault. I think I spent considerable amounts of energy and time compartmentalizing that shame and being like, I'm not going to let this change anything. I'm not going to, like, trying to put a tough face on about it.
Yeah.
So it didn't necessarily, it definitely made me cognizant of, like, when I'll go out, when I'll drink, like if I'll get drunk, things like that. But
right.
It didn't necessarily, I don't think that it deterred me from having casual sex. I don't think that it deterred me from, whether or not I enjoyed that casual sex is a different story.
Mm.
That was, I think that's the thing that I definitely remember feeling like, having these kind of memories of my assault, and then like when I'd be present in a situation with a person being intimate, being like, can I even like this? Like, should I like this? Like, feeling that kind of shame related to the way that I felt in my body, but not necessarily the way that I presented myself outside of that intimate experience.
Yeah, but that sounds like kind of a similar thing to what I was talking about, where like there was that conscious part of you that was like, well, I should be allowed to do this, and this isn't why it happened, and I'm not going to let this change
right.
what I do. But then there were the feelings inside your body. And
yeah.
It, you know, that
yeah.
there was a lot of fear and shame and like just these things that made living in your body so different.
Totally. Yeah. I think in general, I felt really, I've been very fortunate to have a strong sense of my body is mine. My body is inherently okay, like for myself. But definitely after my sexual assault, I know that I was aware of where my body would go, about the spaces my body would like be in, about like the kinds of people that I wanted to be around when my body was there. Like I don't think I was focused on how I was dressing myself per se, but it was definitely about how people are responding to my body that I was a lot more aware of. You know, I became a lot more aware of, I mean, like I had read the textbook things being a volunteer at a crisis center and knowing things like street harassment and this and that, but I became way more attuned to it after my own assault because it was like, well, now I'm picking up on the things that aren't even being said, just the glares, just the glances, just the way that people are taking in somebody's body, the way that somebody's looking at them up and down, the way that I'm getting looked at up and down, you know, things like that.
Yeah, because I think that that's a thing I really noticed after experiencing sexual violence as well, that when you experience the more extreme forms of violence, you become like sensitized to the whole spectrum.
Totally.
And so like the comments that support violence or the looks that feel harmful or the, you know, things
you're
like that.
You're picking up on that with your spidey senses.
Yeah. Because suddenly like the feeling that it gives you, you're like, oh, I know that feeling.
Totally.
And that feeling is when danger happens. That's where violence happens.
Yeah.
And so it's like almost the superpower.
100%. 100%.
And doesn't feel like it when it feels like your world's caving in on you, but it is.
Totally. It very much is. And as well, I think like after years after my assault happened, now it's in the past, I think I used that sense, that sixth sense that I have to be like, yo, when danger is happening, especially when I'm out, right? Like, especially when I'm out and I see a person who looks way too intoxicated, like the way that he's coming at a woman, the way that he's talking about a woman, the way that all of those kinds of things are like telltale signs. And so I'm able to like either interject, intervene, or just like go find a bouncer and be like, that guy's fucked up. Get him out of here.
Right.
He's actually a liability for you. You don't want him here. He's not a good time.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So
you know how to use it.
Totally. Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about our bodies as sites of oppression and violence, but we also want to talk about reclaiming our bodies and what it means to have bodies be the sites of joy and pleasure in our
life. Totally, yeah.
So first, though, we want to talk a little bit about something we don't want to say.
Mm.
Because a lot of times the main message of body positivity is that we all just need to accept our bodies the way they are. And we've been graciously corrected by some trans folks who've done a lot of work to explain how that's actually really not helpful or accurate or supportive for a lot of folks who actually really need to change their bodies, who actually feel much more free and at home in their bodies when they have the ability to do that. So there's an article by Sam Dylan Finch that was really helpful in offering alternatives. And one that really resonated with me was My Body, My Rules.
Ooh, I like that a lot. Yeah. I got a fucking tingle down my back just hearing that.
Yeah, because to me, it speaks volumes about consent. And that includes not only consent for how we might physically interact with someone's body, but also what meanings and definitions might be attached to someone's body.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so
totally.
If it's your body, you get to decide what how that body is defined. And actually, this might be a good place to talk about our Woman of Color of the Week.
Yeah.
So we call the segment Woman of Color of the Week, but we mean that in the most expansive way possible. And we don't actually only celebrate people with binary identities.
Yes, thank you for saying that.
Yeah. So today I want to celebrate a beautiful, brilliant, powerful person named India Moore.
They are beautiful.
Right?
Like, absolutely stunning. They're amazing. I keep on seeing pictures of them, and I'm like, who is this? They're on Pose?
Yeah.
Okay. I need to start watching the show, obviously.
Yeah. And do you follow them on Instagram yet?
No, I've just seen all the press and stuff for Pose, and I'm like, who are they?
Who is
like,
that?
Like, just the most beautiful
face.
Their stage
presence, you
know?
Too.
Yeah,
like, exactly. You can't stop looking at them.
Yes.
So, yeah, I was first introduced to them on the show Pose, where they play a similarly incredible trans woman named Angel. And that could not be a more appropriate name for the character or for India. So anyone who follows India on Instagram knows that they're an incredibly fierce advocate for trans folk and for BIPOC people and really for everyone that needs an advocate. And the reason I thought of India for this episode is that they've been so courageous and transformative in showing up exactly as they are and being vocal about who they really are, despite who we might assume them to be, including being non-binary.
Totally.
And I think especially being a trans person, it can be very difficult. There can be a lot of pressure to then identify as binary because that's sort of the
more palatable thing for cis people.
Yeah.
Kind of, is that what you're...
Like, exactly. Well, and especially because India's trans feminine, and so their femininity or, you know, at times they've talked about their womanhood, right? And that's going to be very often denied by cis people. And so then the only shot that a lot of trans feminine people are going to have at having their femininity respected is to be as binary as possible, to play by the cis rules as much as possible.
I feel you, yeah.
Yeah, like a few months ago, India took a lot of abuse for boldly saying that trans women are biological women and refusing to compromise on that, no matter how much heat they took for that. So they're asking us to look deeper and challenge our assumptions about not just social categories like gender, but also our assumptions about bodies and biology and the meaning that we might make out of those supposedly objective things.
And also, like, science is such an interesting place where we can learn so much if we just Google, right? Like, there's a difference. Like, we all, I don't know, we all, I'm just speaking for everybody, but I'm saying to myself, like, we all know that, like, being a man, being a woman, those are social constructs. Those are things that are malleable over time and space.
Yeah.
They're not fixed.
Yeah.
They're not fixed. Like, that's the thing. Like, I think people have such a hard time wrapping their head around that. So it's such a beautiful thing that they were so unrelenting in, like, being decisive about who they are and then saying, like, I don't give a fuck if you don't like that shit. Because this is fact.
Like, I'm a woman and my biology is what it is.
Yeah.
And you don't get to just use words that you think are scientific in order to invalidate my identity or put me in the box that you want to put me in.
Yeah.
And India's also in a new ad campaign for Calvin Klein underwear.
That's where I've seen them.
Okay.
That is where. And I was like, whoa, who's that?
Yeah. And I also think that's a great example of how we need to center underrepresented voices in our conversations about what change might look like. Because for a lot of cis folks with beauty privilege, modeling wouldn't necessarily be revolutionary. But for a trans person of color to be cast in such a high-profile campaign like that, it is just so meaningful.
But also, like, underwear. That's another, like, that's, I think, like, it's specifically a really, like, powerful thing because we're not saying, like, this body should be hiding away because of whatever reason. It's like, no, this body should be celebrated. And in fact, here's an ad.
Yeah.
By the shits, you
and
know?
The underwear, like, we wear is often very, like, gendered.
100%.
Police, right?
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
So Janet Mock actually said of India, they're the embodiment of our dream girl. They're living the fantasy that all of us hoped and dreamed for, that we fought to build little by little so that someone like India Moore could be the center of a show, be the center of fashion campaigns, be on a magazine cover.
Oof. I mean.
I know. I want to cry just like reading that. Lord. So everyone, please follow India Moore on Instagram. Watch Pose, the best show of all time. And just revel in this incredible non-binary artist and leader who is enriching all of us by just being who they are as loudly as possible.
I love that. That's beautiful. Let's talk about pleasure.
Yeah, I think that's a really good segue into talking about
you like how
pleasure,
I was talking about
pleasure, joy, and reclaiming.
I remember there was a time in my life where I was like starting to have sex. I was 19 when I lost my virginity, and I'm just disclosing shit to you. It's fine.
Yeah, that's what we're here for.
It was awful, but it was also like kind of awesome at the same time. Like I was like, so it wasn't like it was awful in the sense that it like didn't feel great, but it was awesome because I was like, this is my fucking choice. And it was the day before I went like flew away, so I was just like, bye, bitch. Like you can't catch no feelings. But I remember like not being sure about like how is this supposed to feel like am I supposed to like this shit, like it's funner when I rub one out than when I do this shit, like I remember remembering that feeling and being like, this is disappointing, this is what penetration feels like, I don't know if I'm into it, I'd rather not. Like you know,
well, and I mean that speaks also to how much heterosexual sex is defined around male pleasure, right?
Yes.
Because that's literally how the straights define sex.
The straights.
And it doesn't matter at all.
That's derogatory. Stop.
If a woman has, like, there is men in the year of our Lord 2019.
Did you say the year of our Lord? Is this Beyonce's year?
It is, actually. In 2019, there are men on Twitter fully claiming that women don't enjoy sex.
Who says that? You've never really fucked a woman. Clearly. Like, it's like you've never taken
People
the interest
still think
in orgasms. Oh, God.
For a myth.
Okay, so if there's anything that you get from this episode, aside from a lot of other shit we talked about, one of the things that you should remember is your orgasm is yours.
Yeah.
And you're entitled to your orgasm, especially if you're having, you know, sex with men. It's not your job to please men. Our job is to please ourselves, but also recognizing that when we're in intimate situations with another person, it's our obligation and our duty to care about how that other person is faring.
Yes.
Like that's 100%. That's like the golden ticket.
But it can just be so hard. I mean, there's so many cultural ideas around, you know, what makes a slut, you know, that it isn't okay for women to experience pleasure. There's so much shame around it for so many of us. And again, like a lot of us, and I know for me, like I was certainly never told by, you know, my mom or anybody that I shouldn't have orgasms or I shouldn't enjoy sex. Mm-hmm. But again, it's this osmosis where you just pick up the shame that that so many people in our culture have around pleasure.
Yes.
And then we feel bad.
I remember when I first started having sex, the number of times that men would sit be like, I bet you're a freak. Like that was the first thing, like you're freaky. Like, and it's like, okay, so black woman, sex, freaky. That's just it. Like there can never be like, that's it. That's all. And I think I started to recognize that like it's my choice. It is always our choices, the level of freakiness we want to be. Mm-hmm. This isn't a performance. We shouldn't feel obligated to perform. Our bodies are meant for us to enjoy. I've just started to really believe that for myself. I think it's important to recognize like how the world was made for women and femmes specifically to like be disassociated and like cut off from pleasure.
Yes.
And like the shame that we end up feeling when we are seeking pleasure, when we receive pleasure, when we pleasure ourselves. Like I just said, like I learned like about masturbation when I was like 12. Like the amount of shame, girl. Shame. Mm-hmm. Like what do you have to say? Your face is looking like you're ready to explode right now.
Yes. Okay. Because have you read The Uses of the Erotic by Audre Lorde?
No, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. So I just read this for the first time somehow and was like, oh my God, this is life-changing. It puts words to a lot of things that I've been experiencing. But she talks a lot about how we are intentionally disconnected from our sense of pleasure and from our sense of the erotic because it's so powerful.
Mm.
And because systems of oppression rely on us being disconnected from that. So she actually, we're talking about this so much more expansively. She says, the erotic is a resource within each of us that lies in a deeply female and spiritual plane. firmly rooted in the power of our unexpressed or unrecognized feeling. In order to perpetuate itself, every oppression must corrupt or distort those various sources of power within the culture of the oppressed that can provide energy for change. For women, this has meant a suppression of the erotic as a considered source of power and information within our lives.
Information. Right? Okay, so that's like a really beautiful way of talking about, like, because how do we learn what we like? How do we learn when we feel the best? How do we learn about those things?
And yeah, you know? And it's so much deeper, so much broader than in sex. Like, sex is almost the only way that we, some of us, feel like we can experience the erotic. And right. She talks about that.
Yeah.
But it's actually this bigger, like she says, the erotic is an internal sense of satisfaction to which, once we've experienced it, we know we can aspire. And it's much more recent in my life that I've done so much healing work around all of those feelings of, you know, shame and terror and things in mm-hmm. my body. So I've actually been able to experience for the first time that deep yes, you know, like that right. feeling that, sure, it can happen during sex, but it can also happen when I'm working on something that feels really, really
powerful.
Good.
Yes.
Or when I'm just like connecting with a friend or listening to an amazing song.
Yes.
Or eating something amazing. Like,
that's like bomb as fuck. You're like, yes, no, I fully like, and you know, there's this like, oh, it's orgasmic. Like people describe like eating food in that kind of way. And for the longest time I'd be like, what the fuck does that mean? You know, but like it means something. It you're right. It unlocks for so many of us. Sex is the only way we get to that place or that plane.
Right.
But like it actually, knowing that you're able to experience that kind of pleasure unlocks your ability to get there in other ways, in other terms, not related to sex.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that what she's getting at around like why systems of oppression depend on this disconnection is that the violence of oppression, it is so fundamentally wrong and unnatural. Right. And when we actually have knowledge of the erotic, when we have knowledge of what a deep yes, like alignment, good feeling is, mm-hmm. then we can identify, no, this is wrong. This shouldn't be happening. This job that makes me feel like I want to die is not something I want to do. This person that makes me feel like, you know, when they say that and it makes me want to die, like that is wrong.
It's a source of power and information in our lives about how we relate to the world, accept things, have boundaries, create who we want to be, disregard the things that we don't find are useful for us. Like,
I feel like we're tapping into this like much bigger energy when we're able to experience that, when we're able to let it flow through us, which that's that energy that you can use to build something better.
Right. And I feel like it is creative. That's the, like, I think that is inherently a creative, beautiful. And in my mind, it's pure. And speaking specifically about sex, but also other things, like to enjoy your body, that is inherently the most pure form of like loving yourself. Is to like, how much more amazing can it be to be like, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Like that is, you know.
Yeah. So then another idea that has to do with pleasure and has to do with expression. So there's a saying, the first altar is self.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that Soraya Jean-Louis, so she's a Haitian American artist who I'm lucky enough to call a friend. She's always said this, and it's always been something that served as a kind of guiding star for me, because makeup and fashion have always felt like forms of self-expression that are more precious to me than a lot of people might understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I've talked to her about why she says that and what it means to her, she talked about understanding herself as a spiritual being and what that means and how it's both intangible but also material.
Mm-hmm.
And so she'd come to believe through her own feelings and experiences that if we revere certain people and places as sacred, then we can't divorce ourselves from the sacredness of our own bodies. What you just said,
so you're saying like if like you can think that this piece of art is sacred, why can't you see yourself as sacred?
Exactly.
Oh wow, that's powerful.
Yeah, that our bodies are sacred, that we're these spiritual beings, but we also, and that's intangible,
mm-hmm.
but we also are living in these bodies
that are material and real. And
exactly.
Like, you know.
And so celebrating our bodies, appreciating our bodies, experiencing the pleasure that we can only experience in material ways by interacting with our actual physical body, whether that's, you know, whether it's putting makeup on it or putting, you know, jewelry on it or mm-hmm. putting certain clothes on it that make us feel sensual and good, you know, right. or just the way we move our bodies. Just understanding our bodies as sacred is in itself a spiritual practice.
That's so fascinating because the altar, what does it say? The altar,
the first altar is itself.
Growing up as like a super Christian,
yeah.
with a capital IS, you know, there's this Bible verse that's something to the effect of like, your body's a temple of God. But like the caveat to that is that like God requires you to be like pure and abstain and all these other things. So like, how can you, in my mind growing up, I remember feeling like my body is a temple of God. That means that it has to be pure. I can't have sex. I can't do so many things. Like there's so many things I need to do to keep my body pure for God. I think religion oftentimes removes the celebration of self and centers this outward being as opposed to seeing yourself as worthy of being centered as an inward being for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I guess to me, that's one of these examples where organized religion in so many ways takes spiritual truths and distorts them for the purposes of control.
100%.
Right? And so I got really excited about that idea because, yes, temples of God are sacred.
Totally.
And I think there is something about keeping that, I don't want to say keeping it pure because the pure is so loaded.
Yes.
But I mean, I guess when we think about what would it mean to keep our bodies as sacred, I mean, to me, that means things like listening to it, honoring mm-hmm. it, like not if my body doesn't want me to put something in it, whether, you know, then yeah. I'm not going to. If my body is saying no to something, I'm going to respect that. To me, that would be what it is to right. keep my body pure, would be to listen to the rules that my body
is telling
tells me
yeah.
naturally, yes. right? And that's yeah. honoring the sacredness. And so I think, yeah, that's maybe an idea of how something gets twisted around because you can control women by saying, keep your body pure in this way, when right. what it really means is
something completely different. Totally. I think another thing that I, and we've discussed and that I've been like rah-rahing for a while is just this notion, we're thinking about things like our bodies and pleasure, but I think as well, you can't talk about your body when you don't talk about your mind and the way that you actually treat other people and how it treat right. other people, like, you know, just be out here in this fucking world in these streets. And I think your body is a vessel for who you are, you know.
Yeah.
And there's something really, I find it troubling oftentimes when we pour so much into the way that we look.
Right.
And our aesthetic, which can be riddled with appropriation and all these mm-hmm. other things, but it can also be really beautiful and like inherently awesome just for yourself, right? Like it doesn't have to always be yeah. a negative thing. But I think there's a fine line between pouring into self and being courageous with how you accept what your body needs and wants and all those kinds of things we were just talking about.
Yeah.
And also recognizing that like there's more to you than just your body, in that like it doesn't matter how cute you look. It doesn't matter how sexy I think my head is. It doesn't matter how many squats we do. It doesn't matter. It doesn't, like, those things matter to us because they're personal. But I think in the grander scheme of things, it also matters how we treat ourselves and treat other people. Regardless of how a person presents themselves, they're still worthy of respect. Regardless of how I present myself, I'm still worthy of respect. And keeping that kind of energy for like the way that you feel about yourself and loving yourself and externalizing that to other people and showing like genuine care for others.
I think it's so important when we're talking about things like pleasure and, you know, centering our pleasure, that Adrienne Marie Brown, she wrote Pleasure Activism. She actually talks a bit about this, that there's a difference between pleasure and hedonism. Like there's a difference between centering pleasure and using that as a guiding force in your life and doing that at the expense of other people.
There you go.
Right?
That's,
and that's never a thing that
to desire. Yeah.
we ever want to do. It's yeah. not just about pleasure at the expense of someone else. That's a whole different thing.
Yes, yes. Thanks yeah. for saying that. That's important.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I think is really important is just, what does it mean to be less focused on the eyes that are gazing at us? What does it mean to be looking yes. out from behind our eyes, right? And so I think another, like we've talked about experiencing pleasure through our bodies and expressing ourselves through our bodies, but also what do our bodies do for us? Like what's the functionality of our bodies? Like what are we here to do, right? They are the vessel through which we experience the world, and what do we want to
accomplish
experience?
And experience. Totally, I'm with you on that. That's kind of what I'm where I'm coming from, is that like I love my body, I appreciate my body, I expect things from myself, Mm-hmm. Like, my expectations are not of my body. My expectations are of me. Mm-hmm. And I'm more than my body. My body takes me places. My body gets me where I need to go. My body can have privilege. My body can be a site of oppression. But my body is also the vessel for my mind and my thoughts. And I think those are also really important. And I love that you said something about the difference between pleasure and hedonism and yeah. being at the expense of somebody else's well-being. Because I think some of us, especially white women, can end up teetering the line of like indulging in self and body to a point where it's appropriative. And then that's like into the realm of, you know, right. at the expense of somebody else. And I think like that's where we need to kind of take a good hard look as to like, who am I? Where do I stand? What privileges do I have? Which space do I occupy? And like you said, like seeing, not being so concerned with the eyes that are looking at you. That's such a great thing to say.
And I think that where our body, our relationship with our body still matters in that it's going back to the uses of the erotic of, again, it's not what your body looks like, it's what you feel. Mm-hmm. And so there is your mind and your thoughts and the feelings in your body and your intuition. And those are very much connected to what you feel in your body. Your right. intuition is what you're feeling in your body.
Yeah.
And so we can use how we feel in our bodies, even when there's also pain present or even when there's uncomfortable feelings present.
Totally.
We can use what we feel in our bodies mm-hmm. to guide us to our purpose and to guide us to what's right, which includes how we interact with other people.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
Yeah.